Welcome back to Hoops HD, everybody. It is May 28th. I'm Chad Sherwood up here in one corner. We got David Griggs, and we got joining us. Let's start with the giant microphone man down there, Kyle Lamb. Big enough, or you got a bigger one somewhere?
Well, if I did, I wouldn't be able to tell you. We're running a secret operation over here with our big microphones. You know, this isn't as fun as Hollywood Squares, but it's fun enough.
It was hilarious that we couldn't get your microphone working. The microphone the size of a basketball.
Well, you know, David, I didn't pay for this thing based on, per inch. So I don't get necessarily maximum efficiency by size.
I didn't pay for mine either. I think I just kind of found it.
That sounds about right. Stole it, in other words.
Yeah. We also got Galen Clavio back with us. Well, this is a little bit of an old school Hoops HD or pre-Hoops HD type of group, isn't it?
Kicking it back to the Obama administration.
So we had a really good panel for tonight, some good discussions, but unfortunately none of them could make it, so it's just us. Yeah.
I believe, I'm sure your guys' panels are just immensely great every single time. I'm happy to be the disappointing guest. I really am.
So our panel rates better than the last episode of Game of Thrones, so we got that going for us.
Kyle, I thought that you were like the one and only person that actually enjoyed the final episode of Game of Thrones. Isn't that?
Yeah, what can I say? I'm not sure that that's a badge of honor for the Game of Thrones, but I am probably the only one out there that actually enjoyed it.
What are we going to do today? We actually want to discuss a lot of issues going on with in the news with the various court cases going on with the NCAA, as well as some issues with the transfer portal out there. And maybe a little bit appropriate here. We're recording this on May 28th, and just this morning, we got the announcement from a major recruit, RJ Hampton, that he is not going to play in college basketball at all. Instead, he's going to go over to New Zealand, play professionally for 1 year, so be subject to the NBA draft next year. And I'm hearing with endorsement deals and all, could make $1 million for the 1 year alone over in New Zealand. And David, I know you, let me start off with you here on this whole pay for play issue. Isn't that what we're kind of setting up here is, hey, go play somewhere else where you can get paid. Stop playing in the United States.
Yeah, I think so. Three of the things that we wanted to hit on, in addition to news and notes, we'll probably forget the news and notes. We'll do that at the end, sure, if we remember, which we probably won't. So if we don't get around to discussing how Juwan Howard is the new coach at Michigan, sorry. But the three things we wanted to hit on, year one of the transfer portal, the pay-for-play court cases that are going on. Chad's a lawyer. I've been to court a lot, and Galen and Kyle are around college basketball a lot, so we should be able to cover it. And on top of that, so there's the pay-for-play trials, but there's also sort of the end of the FBI probe, and I think they're all kind of related, or could be. It could be that at the end of the discussion they're not related at all, but I think they kind of could be. So that's kind of what we are going to get into tonight. We don't really have an itinerary. We never do. But just kind of jumping up. Chad, what was your question?
I've got no idea. Why don't we start talking about the transfer portal? Because that is, Kyle, I know that you follow this a lot, especially with Ohio State and what you've been doing with them and their podcasts and the like.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's this perception that people there's a perception that basically the wide open West has started with the transfer portal. Now, don't get me wrong. I think we have seen some proliferation from, especially from, you know, the fact that the NCAA are granting more high profile waivers. I think that is causing more kids to enter the transfer portal. Well,
actually, Kyle, before we go any further, can you just, people that don't know, what is the transfer portal?
Oh, yeah.
So the transfer portal is very mysterious. It has these powers and leads to a destination. We don't know where it comes out at. No, for real. So let me back up and explain the way it used to.
It comes out in Beaverton, Oregon.
This is kind of boring. Do you want me to kind of explain it? How it basically how permission to contact worked and how the transfer portal replaced it. Was that where you were going?
I think I got this. But thank you for trying to hijack my answer, David. I appreciate that. Hold on. Actually, you know, there goes my headphones. So maybe actually, David, you can answer real quick. Why I do a little technical assistance here.
Kyle's equipment isn't working. It's just not up to – what a great show we've got. Is anybody even still watching? So anyway, from the beginning of time up until about last year, when a player wanted to transfer, they needed the schools, anybody that wanted to talk to them needed permission to contact from their current school. So what they would do, they would go to their, typically the compliance officer and say, hey, I want to transfer. These are the schools I'd like to talk to. And then they would notify those schools, I say they, the compliance officer, or somebody would, that the player was interested in coming there. It was kind of tedious. It was hours and hours of paperwork. There was such a thing as a blanket permission to contact, which basically gave you permission to talk to everyone. And I think how this started was they just got tired of all the paperwork. So they're like, well, why don't we just eliminate permission to contact? Anybody that transfers will go into the porthole, and anybody that's in the portal can talk to anybody. That is basically how the portal works. Now, the unintended consequence of that was that it kind of created a recruiting service, because any coach, anybody that has access to the transfer portal can go in there and look at players that want to talk to people. But that was really the only change. Schools can still put restrictions on players that transfer. Schools can still block players from doing it, but they no longer need permission to contact, and schools no longer need permission to talk to them. If you see somebody in the portal, you can talk to them without getting permission to contact. That was basically the biggest change. So in order to alleviate paperwork, they unintentionally started what may have been their own internal recruiting service.
That was beautifully stated, David, almost as well as I could have explained it myself. I will add another thing too, is they really, I know it doesn't seem like it intuitively, but they really wanted to try to get away from tampering. And that's not to say tampering doesn't still exist with the portal in place, but now they're basically saying, since coaches at the old schools cannot dictate where a kid transfers or who a kid speaks with in hoping to transfer, basically, they're saying they think that that's going to curtail tampering at least a little bit, because there's not as much to gain by going behind somebody's back and trying to talk to them before they enter the portal. So now you assume they're going to enter the portal and you can start talking to them legally, because you don't have to worry about the school denying permission to speak with them. So they're also hoping that the tampering, they're not stupid. It's not going to go away completely, but they're hoping it won't be as big of a factor.
Well, so Galen, what it kind of sounds to me like is what they did here is they said, okay, everybody's tampered with everybody else, so we'll just make it all legal, right?
I think that's maybe part of it. I think the other part, though, is there's a lot of pressures, and I think that something that Mr. Griggs was alluding to when we were setting this up is that a lot of these different factors are put together, and at the end of the day, one of the least morally defensible stances that the NCAA has set up over the course of time is that these are supposedly students who also happen to be athletes, and yet they can't move from school to school the same way that any other student would be allowed to just change schools. And so I think that that's really had a lot to do with it, is this idea that they almost had to make this move because it's still somewhat controllable right now if you're the NCAA and if you're these individual schools. You can still somewhat dictate the terms of things, but it looks like you're giving athletes more of their own agency in the process of doing it. And I think eventually, and I think you're already seeing it now, where people are like, well, this still isn't a very good deal for the athletes, but it looks better than it used to look. Well,
I can't confirm this, Chad, but I think everybody that's hooked up to an NCAA monitor when they're speaking about athletes, if they don't use the buzzword student-athlete, they get buzzed. And Galen didn't say student-athlete, so he would have gotten buzzed right there.
Okay,
I actually actively refuse to use the term student athlete. When I teach my classes, I tell them, and I have, students who are athletes, varsity athletes in my classes. And I'm like, I'm not going to use that term. You shouldn't use that term. And here's why. And then I give them the whole story. It's great.
God bless Dr. Clavio, a great American.
Well, yeah, it's the technicality. It's why you can't get workers' comp.
Right. David, do we still have, though, the major problem, though, of you still have this one-year residency rule here, which has all kinds of waivers, but if you're a freshman and you want to transfer your sophomore year, you probably have to sit out a year.
You do. You still have all of the problems or issues that existed before. What this did was that it took hours and hours and hours of paperwork away from compliance officers who basically got sick of doing it. I know that that's a cynical way of looking at it, but I think that was a big push for the portal. You still have the year in residency for men's basketball, women's basketball, I want to say hockey and baseball, or the four sports, in football.
Jesus football.
Christ. Yeah.
Football's a little important around.
Yeah. anyway, so sorry. But yeah, you have to sit out a year when you transfer. That's still in place. Schools can still block you from going to other specific schools. So really nothing has changed. And there was an uproar in the media, and I kind of wanted to address this. I know Kyle and Galen follow the media a lot more closely than I do about how this was going to turn into the Wild West and, oh my God, look at all these people in transfer portal. I think if nothing else, if you were to look at the number of players in the portal, athletes, student athlete, whatever you want to call them, and look at the number of permission to contact the year before the portal went into place, there might be more in the portal, but not so much more that it's alarming. So I think if not, just because you're in there doesn't mean you're going to transfer.
What I think is hilarious about the portal, you're absolutely right. It hasn't created the Wild West. It hasn't done anything other than basically make more visible the transfer market that already existed. But what's hilarious is how whiny coaches have gotten about the transfer portal. It is incredible. And I forget who it was that made, I think it was Mike Bray that made some comments the other day about, the problems with the transfer portal. And my response to that was, it seems like coaches are having a real hard time dealing with adversity when it comes to this stuff, because it really isn't that big of a deal. It's certainly not out of the realm of, normal player movement, as you just said. But these coaches with their $1 million-plus contracts in many cases at the biggest schools, they're the ones that are making the most noise. And it has very little to do with player movement. It has everything to do with loss of control. And I think that's the thing that's been most irritating to me watching their reactions, is that's the problem.
Galen hit the nail on the head right there. That's all this is about. It's about loss of control. I would remind people, David mentioned those five sports that have the year in residency rule. Those are not just the only five sports at Division I that has the year in residency rule, but those are the only sports at any level of division of the NCAA period. Divisions two and three have the one-time transfer exception, which basically means regardless of whether you're the quarterback for the football team in Division III or whether you're a swimmer and diver at Division I, you can transfer one time without sitting out as long as you're eligible at the time of your transfer and right, you meet all those requirements. So this is not just about football or about Division I football or basketball. It's like this rule applies to everybody else. If you're an athlete at any other level of any other sport, you can transfer without sitting out. That's why this is totally about, the coach's control.
Right. And the piggyback off of that, and again, I wanted to make sure I got to make this point, not to steer it away, but men's basketball, when you look at the transfer rates, I want to say the number is 60%. It varies from year to year. Don't even go to another Division I school. So when you hear these astronomical numbers like 400 are transferring, 500 are transferring, a lot of them are going down, so to speak. Like less than half of those are going to a D1 school. And why do players transfer? While it is absolutely true, and I'm not going to deny, that players want a better opportunity. They want to trade up, so to speak. They're a standout player at an under-the-radar school, and they want to play at Kentucky. The vast majority of them transfer because – you have 13 scholarship players, you have five guys that start, you have six or seven that are happy with their playing time, and you have about six that aren't. They either want to leave for more playing time, or most commonly, the coaches want them to leave because they want to offer the spot to someone else. So in my opinion, it is highly hypocritical for these coaches to whine about transfers when they're the ones that are instigating way more than half of them.
Well, let's kind of go from this. I want to go back to the
with that. I mean, I'm not the only one that's around athletes, but why do
you? No, you're right. It's coaches want to be able to have guys in reserve. I get that, but this is college sports. And if you're going, this is where the, you know, you can have an NFL roster or an NBA roster where you, you know, the NBA roster, you got 15 guys, you got three of them that don't dress. You're paying those guys at the end of the bench. You know, there's a financial incentive at least for them to be around. You don't get that in, say, college basketball, college football. You might find that your playing time's not going to exist at the spot you're at. So I agree with you completely, David. It's
there for tuition and the love of the game, Darnell. Sure.
Well, let me ask. That kind of all leads into the next topic we want to hit on, which is the erosion of the NCAA. Their losses in these court cases and the idea of pay for play here. And is that where this is all kind of going to? And this is kind of the NCAA do everything they can to hold on to.
Yeah. Did you guys see there was an article 2 weeks ago about how the NCAA is forming a working group, I'll put that in scare quotes, looking at how its rules can be modified. I'm quoting from the news service article, how its rules can be modified to allow college athletes to be compensated for use of their names, images, and likenesses. Now, when this story came out, I immediately quote tweeted it and said, this is a waste of time. Don't pay any attention to it, because I can almost guarantee you that's what's going to happen is they're going to put this blue ribbon commission together. Probably Condoleezza Rice will be on it. And at the end of it, they're going to come out and say, there's no way that we can compensate allow athletes to be compensated for likeness and still maintain the principles of amateurism, but they have to pay lip service to it. Because I think right now you hit the nail on the head, Chad, the NCAA is in the same precarious spot that Major League Baseball was in the late 1960s, where they're trying desperately to hang on to an antiquated system where they have financial control over scenarios when it comes to players. And yet time has marched on and the legal system is marching on and societal expectations are marching on. And what you're getting now is the NCAA desperately trying to make it look like they're doing things outwardly while actually not doing anything because there's so much internal inertia within the member schools. So I think all of this fits in, and I think all of it creates a situation where, you know, something's going to happen, whether that's external court pressures or whether that's a group inside the NCAA saying, look, we need to modernize or die. But you're going to have to see some kind of change. Fair enough. Okay.
Here's the thing, Gail, not to interrupt you, but, I
was done
it anyway, but like the NCAA since 2016 has basically been getting its ass kicked in court. Now, there hasn't been a jackhammer, but there's been a lot of little hammers. You know, you had the player for UCLA, the O'Bannon
case. Ed O'Bannon.
Yeah, thank you.
Was it Charles or Ed? I can't remember which.
It was Ed.
Right. Okay. You had the NLRB ruling that players fit the definition of athletes. You have this case in California going on right now that's should athletes be allowed to make money off their likenesses? And I think the NCAA has not been responding at all. And I almost think it's either they're naive or they literally just don't know what to do. It's almost like to reference Game of Thrones, winter is coming and they are not prepared to handle it. I just don't think that there's a plan. And if they're not careful, they're going to lose control of everything, because and I'm glad Chad is here. Well, I'm almost never glad that Chad's here, but him being a lawyer, I'm glad he's here now. The letter of the law is against the NCAA for this reason. If you were to ask the question, if players were allowed to be paid, would they be? The answer is unquestionably yes. We're going to get to this. They're not allowed to be paid, and a lot of them are being paid. So, of course, they would be if they're allowed to be paid.
The NCAA is in a precarious position here because they have a lot of angles to this. You've got what the coaches and you know, the coaches are on the president's case trying to keep control, as Galen mentioned earlier. Yeah. That's part of it. But then you have the legal angles where you have to worry about, you know, are athletes treated like employees?
How is it not legally price fixing is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, you've got the antitrust issues there as well, and you've got the fact that the NCAA is supposed to be an educational mission, and it's hard to argue it as an organization that makes a couple billion dollars in revenue and paying out 90% of that back to the schools you know, it's really hard to argue that they're still fulfilling a purely educational mission, because that is no longer, you know, most people would argue that is not what they're doing now. So they're trying to win these cases without actually taking a stance, and they don't want to create a precedent because that could get them too far down the, you know, down the river. So yeah. That's why you see them settling a lot of these cases, because they don't want actual outcomes to make them have to stick to, you know, whatever legal angle they're trying to avoid.
One thing I will say on this, I think that there's a lot of different stakeholders. You mentioned the coaches who make a lot of, you know, they make all the money. You've got athletic directors who make a lot of money, but the athletic directors are kind of in a different spot. You know, there's really, it feels like there's two groups among athletic administrators in NCAA, like particularly Division I schools. There's the people that are a lot of former athletes who really have drank the Kool-Aid, so to speak, as far as, oh, you know, this is for the love of the game and for the educational stuff and all of that, and, you know, athletes should be you know, they should be thankful for what they get from schools. And like that's an interesting faction. But then I think there's also a faction that realizes it's a business, treats it as a business, and does everything that you would need to do to make it run as a business, but is, you know, terrified to actually make any changes because they don't want to lose the tax shield and the revenue shield that supposedly amateur athletics is providing them. And so it ends up being this fascinating mixture that doesn't have, I think that's where some of the inertia you're talking about, David, comes from. It's like there's too many stakeholders who have too much skin in the game already for any of those groups to voluntarily say, yeah, let's give a chunk of revenue to athletes and let's change the way we do business. There's not a lot of appetite for that right now.
Well, and it's, you know, I own my own business. I'm an attorney. I have my own practice. I would have a staff of a dozen people working for me if they worked there for free and I had no payroll expense.
Sure.
That's what you're getting. I don't have the money for that payroll expense, but it's another huge expense is going to come in here.
Chad, I'm curious your opinion, since you are the attorney of the group and you're a little better than a park bench attorney. I am curious where you see this going, you know, with all these legal cases we've seen. You know, do you see the structure of the NCAA changing in the near future with all this?
I think we are headed for a major blow up here, especially because I think this kind of ties into our third point, even because if you are not going to be paying them on the books, guess what? These kids are going to get paid under the table, which is exactly where we ended up with the FBI. So,
yeah, one of the things is like the old debate was, do athletes deserve to be paid or not? I think we're way past that. I think we're going down the road of, while that might be an interesting discussion, it's now into the territory of they're losing in court, and eventually, whether you think they should or shouldn't, the courts are going to order that they have to.
Well, yeah. I mean, you are, and don't give me this nonsense about, oh, you're getting the free tuition. David, you've done this a little bit of research on this. Exactly how much money does that free tuition actually cost the school? Does it cost the school that tuition money?
In most cases, it doesn't cost them anything. And the reason is, well, they get all this money. They spend all this money on scholarships. Who the hell do you think they write the check to? The athletic departments. Like, if it's a private school with a set enrollment, like if it's a Xavier or not, you know, a place that gets more applications than what they accept, then yes, you're arguably losing money because you're giving someone a spot in the school that otherwise would have been paying for it. But if you're like most of the schools out there, these big public schools that are just trying to grow their enrollment, they're essentially spending money that doesn't leave the university. They write a scholarship check and it goes to the general fund. The books go to the bookstore. The housing goes to housing. The meal plan goes to the dining services. Just about everything they're spending is spent within the school.
Yeah, let's make this clear, because I know from my perspective, you know, dealing with a lot of people on a daily basis, there's a lot of lack of awareness about this. Very, very few situations are kids actually getting a free education. Somebody is paying for it. It's not just the school saying, oh, you know, come into our school and we'll give you free tuition and not charge you. No, the school is actually getting paid for that tuition. Usually it's coming from the athletic department. Sometimes it's coming from fees raised by student fees. But yeah. Somebody is paying for that. The school is not giving a free tuition. Somebody is paying for it.
So Kyle, this is like when my bookkeeping department writes a check to my to my payroll department. I, you know, hand myself money and.
And then avoid paying taxes on it, right?
Accounting.
Well, I'm saying no, but that's kind of the point. Is like it is a closed system in a lot of ways. And look, everybody needs to remember why college athletics exist at almost any level. It's the marketing of the school. You know, Butler goes to a couple of national championship games in basketball, and its enrollment. Or its application numbers skyrocket. It's able to be more selective in the people that it's bringing in. You see that effect with SEC schools, with their football programs. There, for the universities, there's a tremendous off-the-books marketing impact in terms of having high-level college athletics. And so, you know, when you talk about, you know, there's going to be a major blow up here or things are going to change, the colleges and universities, on the one hand, they realize that unless they're an Ivy League school or a place like the University of Chicago, they still need the marketing juice that having major college athletics provides them in order to get their name out there, in order for people to know that they exist as a school. But, you know, there also, I think, are a lot of concerns in the college athletics landscape, whether it is, are we going to have to start paying athletes? Is this a situation where there's price fixing? Do we have to worry about, you know, CTE, lawsuits coming down the pike in football? Like, there's all these things where the cost-benefit analysis for college athletics is going to be really interesting, because as much as colleges and universities want to have college athletics, it's like what are they willing to do and how much do they want to reform the system given all of the things that they're facing moving into the middle part of the 21st century?
And that's a good point here, because could we see a group of colleges that just don't want to be Division I anymore if all this does happen? Could we see from 353 teams down to 150 teams, or maybe the alternative, the major conferences breaking off and forming their own?
I will tell you, Gene Smith at Ohio State has said if they have to pay players, they will go Division III.
Is a liar.
Yes, of course.
Good luck with that. I want to pay.
It's such a bluff. I'm so tired of it. Gene Smith probably is among the 15 or 20 people that could chart the course for Division I. Idea that, we're going to drop out of it. Someone else said that too, is another major college president. And it's like, get off your high horse. Like, you're the ones. Ohio State has an athletic budget of what, $200 million a year?
220, I think it was last year.
I mean, give me a break. The idea that Ohio State or any major BCS level school isn't secretly kind of prodding things along and enjoying the current state of things and wouldn't be the best and most financially prepared to take advantage of a situation where you could pay athletes for their likenesses, where you could pay athletes compensatory money. They're not the ones it's going to negatively impact. They just have a vested interest in trying to keep things status quo as long as they can, partially from a public relations perspective.
But let me throw another question here, Galen, though. Don't you also have the idea that if you're allowing people to get paid for their name, image, and likeness, allow them to also get endorsement deals? We don't need Ohio State to pay a kid if Nike will pay a kid.
I generally, I agree, and I don't understand the resistance at this point, except that once you allow that to happen, the entire artifice of amateurism as an argument against compensating athletes at the individual college level goes away. Because you can't very well argue that someone who's getting paid for their likeness, allowing to be signing endorsement deals, that person's an amateur. And look, amateur is a stupid designation anyway. It needs to go away. It has roots in 1850s aristocratic England. Like, it has nothing to do with college athletics, except that it's a convenient way to avoid paying athletes. But when you lose the argument that, they're amateurs, so they can't be paid, then suddenly you start to open the floodgates. And that's where I think maybe not the big schools at first, but, your Mountain West Conference teams, your Sun Belt teams are like, they're not amateurs. We're getting the checkbook out and you can come play for us. And then suddenly everything's on the table. It's kind of like, it's why there's a hard salary cap in the NBA, because teams can't help themselves from paying too much money for players. And I think colleges and universities realize they're not going to be able to help themselves in that situation either. It'll be a free-for-all.
Well, see, Okay, Chad mentioned, will a lot of programs leave Division I? I don't think they will. I think they'll stay Division I and not pay their players or not pay them very much, because the ultimate question, if you were allowed to pay them, would schools do it? Some would, others wouldn't. And you, what you would have is that you'd have about 15 or 20 schools that are getting 4- and 5-star recruits, and then you'd have everybody else. I think
So you'd have the present day system.
Yeah, you would basically have.
you just described Division I FBS football.
Yeah. Well. I mean, am I wrong?
I think you are wrong, because this was the argument back in the 30s and 40s and early 50s. This idea that, you know, schools had been paying players under the table for 30, 40, 50 years by that point, and there was this, you know, supposedly last ditch effort to rein that back in and not have scholarships or anything like that. And schools started giving out scholarships, and then everybody started giving out scholarships. Like, it wasn't just 15 or 20 that said, we're going to do this, and the rest of the schools were like, no, we're not. Once a few started to do it, everybody started to do it.
It's funny Galen said that, okay, because this amateurism argument is literally over 120 years old. Back in 1900, The NCAA didn't come around to 1906, but the schools that eventually made up the NCAA, they were having the discussions in 1900 whether to hire professional baseball coaches that were baseball players during the summer to join the schools and coach the players. And back then they were saying, well, is this going to violate amateurism if we're bringing in professionals? And then, as Galen said, by the 30s and 40s, everybody was already paying players. So this amateurism argument has been around longer than the NCAA itself. So it's just funny that we're still having this conversation, because they've been dragging their feet for over a century on this.
Okay, amateur needs to go with student-athlete then, but go ahead, David.
well, okay, right now, when you look at a conference like, you know, the Summit League, and you look at a conference like the ACC, I don't think that being allowed to pay players is going to suddenly give the ACC any tremendous advantage over leagues like the Summit that don't pay as much or not at all than what they already have. That's kind of what I was getting at.
Well, if you look at paying players, aren't you looking at paying them for their name, image, and likeness? What is the last guy at the end of the bench on a SWAC team worth versus what a Zion Williamson is worth? I mean,
I agree with you, Chad. I think here's the issue when it comes to that. It's not like the name, image, and likeness stuff. You're probably only going to have a few players per team, except at the very big schools, even be able to qualify for that. But I think that where it gets sensitive, from my perspective, is you have so much money being made off of the sports that certain athletes are playing, and the idea that, you know, what is it in the Big Ten this year, each school is going to generate approximately $40 million just off of the television contracts.
I think they said next year it'll actually be like $52 million.
Yeah, and so the idea that I'm a member of a 13 player basketball team, a scholarship member, or I'm a member of a football team, I'm one of the 85 scholarship athletes, and that's where the majority of the money is being made, and I'm not getting any compensation for that. I think there is a convincing argument that, yes, name, image, and likeness is an important thing, and players should be able to capitalize on that, but the idea that I should get none of the money that's coming in from television revenues when it's my labor and my actions that are helping to generate that revenue, at least in part, I think that's something that's going to need to be taken care of in the courts as well.
And by the way, Galen, there's also more money coming to the schools than just the TV contracts.
Totally,
the TVs the schools can sell naming rights to stadiums. They they can sell the advertisements and the endorsements and all that other stuff.
And it's funny.
That's the thing. It's going to be beneficial, because once they open up that floodgate and allow players to benefit off of their and profit off of their own names and likenesses, that's going to allow the schools to actually just go full bore into this. You know, you could have the EA Sports, you know, college football game come back, and you can go all into making as much money off of the branding and the marketing as you want, because you know you're going to be paying back the players some of that money. So it's like, you know, why not? Why stop? You know, why stop short of how much money we can expose on this? And the Zion Williamson's, let's face it, he goes to Duke because of the branding for NBA anyway. So it's not like he didn't pick the school without branding in mind. So how much money he makes off his likeness at Duke is not really a huge factor, I think, in the overall grand scheme of things for why he's picking a school, because he was already – the Zion Williamsons of the world were already taking that into account before they chose a college.
Well, David, do you have any why don't I ask you this? Do you have any thoughts on those last comments by Kyle and by Galen?
No, I mean, I pretty much agree with them. I know a lot of people watching this that are anti-paying players and pro-amateurism. The one thing is, well, what about the other sports, the Olympic sports, the country club sports, whatever you want to call them, and what about Title IX? While that is important, I still think they're not getting – I think proportionally they would continue to get to the same as they would, because a lot of those – athletes are not on full scholarships. A lot of them don't get the full funding. The coaches don't make as much anyway. I don't know enough to know how much it would throw Title IX off, but at least the access to the education would be about the same. I don't think it would make as big of a deal. I don't think it's a showstopper. In fact, I think that that's just something convenient that people talk to that don't want to.
Totally. It's become the new, oh, it would be too complicated to figure out how to pay everybody. I mean, it hasn't been settled in court that all athletes would be required to be compensated the same, because as you said, not all scholarships are the same. It's not like a football scholarship and a women's softball scholarship are equal. A lot of times schools are having to split scholarships between 3, 4, 5 athletes. And, you know, the other thing I would argue, if you're going to try to bring Title IX into the equation, are you going to start requiring that coaches for equivalent sports on either side of the gender divide get paid the same?
I would love that.
Know, I mean, it'd be fascinating if, you know, men's basketball coaches and women's basketball coaches had to be compensated at equal rates.
Wait a second. Gino has to take a pay cut?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. How do you free up money to pay everybody? Bring in Title IX and say that you can't pay the coaches. You have to pay them a mere.
Very selective application of Title IX. I find it quite fascinating.
I would not think, and maybe Chad would be able to answer this better, but I would not think that if you just limit it to paying for the likeness and be a branding and marketing, you know, commercials and autograph signings, I would think that that would not apply to Title IX, because it's not the schools earning it directly. It's the athletes going out and earning what they're worth. And so I would not think that that would apply to Title IX.
But here's the thing. You're right, Kyle, but I'm even talking about within the universities themselves. I mean, there's no requirement that there be completely even compensation across the board. And when you're talking about faculty members, when you're talking about administrators, there's all kinds of factors that are going to be put into those situations. Now, if there's blatant discrimination going on, that's one thing, but you also have to factor in this case, you're not talking about students, you're talking about employees. And,
right.
And you know, one employee that performs a service that is worth significantly more money than another, there's not a requirement that those two employees be compensated equally, which is where I think the Title IX argument in this particular case falls down.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and I agree with that. You know, we've gone a little bit over the time we're going to go here tonight already, actually, though. I guess on that note, I do want to run through each of you for any other final thoughts on this topic here. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what the next couple of years have in store on this. But Kyle, let me start with you.
Yeah, look, I think that we're heading this direction. I've always been an advocate of paying players. And when I say paying players, that does not mean paying them a salary necessarily. I actually used to be more for that than I am now. I'm actually now kind of against that. But I am for them profiting off their likeness. My final thought here, the hope and vision that I have for this is that I'm okay with the NCAA actually regulating this somewhat, come up with some kind of clearinghouse that sets the rates for them, set the rate for an autograph signing, set the rate for a commercial, let everybody make the same amount, but there's no limit as to how many times you can, make a commercial or whatever, and let the market decide that part of it. And just that gives you a chance to at least regulate the people that are paying these athletes, but still allow them to have some free market earnings. So that's the route I hope that they go on this.
Right. And Galen has had a magical change of scenery here, I think.
Yeah.
Got a lot brighter around me. I'll say this. I think nothing's going to change of note in the next couple of years. I think that again, there's way too much inertia in terms of the member schools. I do think what I'm, this is kind of my new area of curiosity. I'm fascinated with what's going on with esports right now, because what's going on with esports, this is an area that is generating a tremendous amount of audience attention, is starting to generate a tremendous amount of revenue. And you're seeing schools, rather than go to the NCAA and try to start esports as a sport within the NCAA, they're just forming their own leagues, or they're joining leagues that are outside of the purview of the NCAA. And I think that there's it's starting to open universities' eyes to the idea that, you know, we can have competitive collegiate athletics, you know, albeit in esports in this case, and not have it go through this lens of amateurism in the NCAA. And I think that that is going to start turning people on in college situations to this idea that, you know, maybe there's a way for these things to coexist. We can have money and we can have athletics, and the world's not going to come to a close. So that's something to keep an eye on moving forward. I don't think anything like that's going to happen next couple of years, but I think that seed might get planted as these legal issues start to mount for the NCAA and its member schools.
David, you want to finish us off?
Yeah, one issue that we didn't talk about really at all that we were going to get to, but we kind of ran out of time, we might table it for later, is this, the end of the FBI probe. And the one thing is, how can you say that these players would not be compensated if they were allowed to be, when a lot of them are being compensated when they're not allowed to be? And you know, one of the things it spurred, you know, not to kind of preach here, but it spurred this Rice Commission, and they looked at it. And what annoyed me about that was they led with the one and done rule. And they act like that. I think a lot of people's who are critical of the one and done rule, if you were to ask them, how can we bring peace to the Middle East? They would be like, well, we certainly got to get rid of the one and done rule. I mean, like, it's just not, and people act like players never played their freshman year and went to the NBA before it was in place. You know, Luol Deng played 1 year, and you know, there's 4,500, whatever 13 times 353 is, that's how many Division I players there are, and maybe 8 to 10 of them are impacted by the one and done rule. So when asked to fix college basketball because of all this corruption, their lead thing was to go to players, that was to go to something that didn't affect 99.8% of them, and that quite frankly didn't need their help anyway. Whether those players are paid in college or not, their prospects are fine. And, you know, Chad and I, we do the Under the Radar podcast every week, and it's like, what about them? There's 75, I think there's 150,000 professional basketball players in the world. There's half of them, about 75, 80,000, are making more than 50,000 a year. Based on the NCAA's own research, like 52% of players that are eligible for the draft end up playing pro basketball, yet they're focused on the ones that probably need their help the least. And those are the ones that are going to be millionaires, whether they make money in college or not. And, you know, if amateurism is such a problem, I think that when you have a product, even at the under the radar level, of players that could play professionally and make 50, 60,000, they're attractive to agents. Agents do approach them. And, you know, how many of them do you think are getting paid? Do you think it's just the ones that were uncovered in the trials, or do you think it's way, 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 way deeper than that? And that was kind of what I wanted to see. Like, should they be paid? Well, they are.
Well, let me chime in on one thing real quick on this, because I think I know Chad loves soccer, so I think bringing this up makes sense. But, you know, Americans act like we're the only country in the world that has athletes under the age of 18. And, you know, you look at Europe, you look at South America, you look at how youth athletic development happens there, and you have a much more logical system of training, you have a much more logical system of identifying young talent. It doesn't always necessarily work in terms of development, but there's at least some logic to it. And, you know, and look, there are young players who are paid for by agents or are compensated by teams. They're developed, they're brought to academies, things like that. It happens all over the place. Like, the idea that it doesn't happen in American sports because we have this convoluted educational system is kind of ludicrous. So look, I think that there's a lot of wish fulfillment that takes place when people talk about college athletics and the way that they want things to be and the fairy tales that they were raised on, like no one ever got paid in the old days and those who did were punished and sent to jail. Like none of that actually happened. Like it's always been a system where yeah. there's been rules and then there's been what's really happened right under the surface. And I think people are starting to become more aware that yes, high school age kids get compensated. They get paid for their services because they're valuable. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that value. We should embrace it and not act like it doesn't exist.
Yeah. Do you think kids have been going to play for Mike Krzyzewski for 30 years and have them getting paid under the table? You are simply ignorant, folks.
Yeah, but
their mom or dad is getting a job that pays six figures at, you know, like a factory near Durham. It just because of their skills, not because of their well, kids.
I know Kyle and Galen follow pro basketball and pro sports more than I do. How much does an agent make?
A good one is making several million.
Let me rephrase the question. How much of what percentage of a contract does an agent get?
4% generally.
How much?
4% generally.
4%.
Some of them will get like 25% on marketing and endorsement deals.
Right.
But 4%.
Is it worth their time to reach out to players at even under the radar schools that could potentially make $50,000 and $60,000 a year playing basketball somewhere in the world to make 4% of that?
Well,
I think
here's the thing that it's like investing in stocks. If you're a day trader, if you're someone that's trying to make money, you don't just buy sure thing stocks because you're not going to get the return on investment that you want. You're trying to uncover, especially in athletics, you're trying to cast a net relatively wide because if you spend money on 100 players, and one of them hits, then guess what? You could make your career based off of that one player. And that's what Nike does. That's what Adidas does. That, like, the whole idea of these the AAU programs that they sponsor and the camps that they put on, it's not anything other than we're going to take a chance on a wide variety of athletes. And if only one or two of them hit, that the money we're going to make off of that one or two players is going to pay for everything else that we do, and it makes it worth all of the investment that we're making.
Right. And to my point, Galen, these players are a lot of college basketball players. Basically, anyone that's a contributing player at the Division I level mostly is going to be attracted to somebody that's an agent.
And what's wrong with that? Yeah.
Nothing.
Well, if you think your job is going to be playing professional basketball, and that's what most of the players of the caliber we're talking about are thinking, then the idea is, okay, I need to work with somebody who can help me get to that level, which might not be a college coach, because the college coach's primary job is to not get fired. And they do that they do that by going and getting athletes who can help them not get fired. Yeah. If they happen to be a coach who also helps you get to the professional level, then great. But are you going to trust a college coach if you're a high schooler? I wouldn't at this point.
Yeah, no, my point wasn't that it's a problem per se. My point was that agents reach out and pay players at all levels of college basketball, probably more than what we think or that what a lot of other people think. And it's probably been going on for a while. The fact that the FBI blew up one agency doesn't even scratch the surface.
Yeah. David, I think Chad is wanting to get to the Bachelorette.
Okay. Bachelorette. Now I'm going to go rewatch the finale of Game of Thrones, Kyle. It's my favorite
episode ever. Winter is coming.
Hey, David, I just want you to know I was going to give you a standing ovation, but then I thought to myself, you don't have legs, so you might take that as me mocking you, so I'll resist.
I guess on that note, I do want to thank everybody for joining us on behalf of Galen Clavio, Kyle Lamb, the puppet over there. I'm Chad Sherwood, and we're back again next month with another podcast.